Hello, my name is John Smetanka, and the name of our program is With Respect. Today's guest on With Respect is Christine Sneed. Christine is an author of novels, but also of many other articles and publications, award-winning author, and she's come out with a new book called Please Be Advised, A Novel in Memos. Fascinating book, fascinating person, Christine Sneed, With Respect. We'll be right back. Christine, how are you today?
I'm doing all right.
Good.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, Christine, I would ask the same question of you as I ask of everybody else who's on this show, and it is this. Where are you from originally?
I'm originally from central Wisconsin. My mom's side of the family is from Princeton and Green Lake, so about half hour or so from Fond du Lac. I think it's just west of there. But then I grew up in the suburbs of Chicago. And stayed there until just a few years ago, other than college and grad school. I moved out to Pasadena in 2018. So the LA sprawl, I just was looking for better weather and also wanted to learn how to write for the screen.
Oh.
And yeah.
So well, you know, it's
that was a big move.
You know, it's interesting. I just happened to be at lunch today. My assistant and I went out to lunch and the waitress who was working at us came originally from Pasadena, and with a stop in Hawaii, now is in the Midwest. And one of the fascinating, we got talking about her moves around the country and about living in Pasadena. I thought, you know, I really don't like you because Pasadena, warm, Hawaii, warm, Midwest, cold, dark, dismal. So given all that, I still am really pleased to be able to talk to you. So tell me about yourself. Where's your where you rose to prominence with writing and somewhat in the Midwest, and you went out to California. But tell me about your family.
You know, my mother is the oldest of nine children, and she became a veterinarian when I was a senior in high school. She actually graduated from veterinary school two weeks before I graduated from high school. So she was going back and forth from Libertyville, Illinois, which is where my dad and my mom and I, we all lived, but she was living in Madison, Wisconsin during the week and then coming back to Northern Illinois every weekend. I still sort of marvel over how she did that for 4 years. And my dad, who's actually my stepdad, but he's been with my mom and me since I was three. He's from Evanston, Illinois. So he's from not too far from where my parents still live and from where I spent most of my formative years. And he worked at the Board of Trade and the Options Exchange for a while. But he's always been sort of a writer at heart. He was a journalism major. That's more probably information than you needed, but
actually, I'm very interested in that. In fact, you mentioned the Board of Trade, and has been the central part of a number of novels, books, whatever. A very interesting place where the grain and the corn, wheat, and everything was traded on today, still is today, but played a part in some of the muckraking books back in the early 1900s. fascinating place, great stories. So yeah, both of those are, but how do they mesh that? You've got a grain trader meets veterinarian.
Well, he wasn't really on the mercantile exchange. He worked for, I don't even know that much about it. I know he was working for this one man for a while, Harry Brandt, and traded Teledyne stocks. And then all the intricacies of it, it was my teenage attention span. I just didn't really understand a lot of it. And
yeah,
but he was a house painter. He'd gotten out of college and he was up in Green Lake with a good friend of his, and they were working for a carpenter / I don't know, he must have also run a painting business kind of at loose ends after college. And he met my mother, who was recently divorced and raising me. And I think he just, the early to mid 70s, I think they fell in love and they stayed together. So
yeah,
Green Lake was where they met in Wisconsin. So
let me ask you this. Did you have any brothers or sisters that you interacted with? I mean, you had a different families, but how about your mom? Had nine, was one of nine. How about you? Are you one of two or 12?
I'm one of one.
Oh, good.
yeah. I've never had a sibling. My mother and my stepdad Terry, I think they thought about having more children, but it just never happened. And
yeah.
I don't know. I've never regretted being an only child. I had a lot of cousins and friends in the neighborhood. It was a pretty lively childhood. I never felt that lonely or anything.
Yeah.
I think some kids do, but I fortunately didn't have that. You know,
that's interesting.
I didn't feel lonely.
What got you into writing?
You know, my parents were both readers, my dad especially. I should say when I say dad, I mean my stepdad, Terry.
For sure.
He was a journalism major in college, and he, I think, had writerly aspirations. But he admitted to me not long ago, he said, I think you just have to be really tough about rejection and facing it and just getting past it. And I think that was the part that just a lot of writers I know who are good and he is a good writer. He just couldn't deal with, having to just constantly submit your work and deal with quite a bit of rejection before you have a breakthrough. And then even after you have one, you don't necessarily always get acceptances. But both my parents read and they pretty much always just said, you do what you want to do. I liked school. I was a pretty good student. So I think they just figured I'd find my way. And I starting probably when I was 11 or 12 and I was keeping a diary and writing bad love poetry and silly stories, I just kept at it over the years and never just kept even getting more invested in it. The year I studied abroad, I was a French major in college and I studied in France.
Oh.
And that year, my junior year in Strasbourg, I had a lot of free time, as it turned out. And so I read a lot and I kept a diary. And that was when I started keeping one more or less religiously and just felt like I don't have to ask permission. I can just be a writer. So,
That's interesting because one of our prior guests, I always remember one of the comments she made, Gillian Flynn, has been a best-selling writer.
Yeah, Gone Girl.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I asked her, how did you start writing these really scary books? I mean, I was a prosecutor for a bunch of years and now defense attorney at times. And so I'm familiar with murders and deaths and all kinds of bad behavior. But I read those three of her books. They scared the hell out of me. I mean, it was... And I said, how'd you do that? And she said, well, when I was a little girl, I used to write stories to scare myself. And now that's what I do. And I thought, well, you're very good at it. You're very good at it.
As a defense attorney and a trial lawyer, I thought about this a lot. Police officers, too, just the fact that you have pretty intimate acquaintance with the darker aspects of human character. I mean, there must have been days when you didn't want to go to work. How did you deal with that?
Well, you know, that's interesting you mentioned it, because there are days when, for whatever reason, whether you are frustrated putting a case together, where you have a tough case to put together, or you have a particular victim or crime that is just so awful it gets into your soul, and you just have to work at it. You just have to put your head down and plow ahead into the wind. Yeah, sometimes it. I remember one particular case, sexual molestation by a boyfriend of the mom, and it was a young 4-year-old girl, and when this girl finally was able to tell what happened to her in court, we had a crusty old judge. And we had myself as prosecutor and defense attorney, and the mom was there in court. And this kid told her story, and the court reporter, the prosecutor, me, the judge, the bailiff, and the defense attorney were in tears. Mm-hmm. Just to hear what this kid was telling about the life that she was forced to live. And so, yeah, it gets into you. It does get into you. But the other ways, on the other side, you've got to provide some distance. There has to be the ability to objectify to some extent, rather than every case is a subjective involvement of your psyche. Although, one of the things that most trial lawyers will tell you is that the most difficult time in your life is the 25 or 30 seconds it takes for the jury to come from the jury room back into the jury box to deliver a verdict. Because if you've done a good job, if you put your whole soul into this case, that verdict is either an affirmance or a rejection of the lawyers, as well as whatever the victims and the whatnot. And so you do really get wound up, and that period of time, that 15 or 20 or 30 seconds it takes for all the juries to get into the box, very, very stressful. And that's the way it is. So that's enough about me, more about you. So I see in your bio, you are a teacher, you are a writer, and what else do you do, if that's not enough?
You know, it's a good question. I remember one year my dad saying to me when I was younger, he's like, "You're difficult to buy gifts for because you don't have a lot of hobbies." And I was kind of offended, and I thought, well, I mean, reading is a big hobby, but it's also now part of my vocation, I guess you could say. I do like to be outside. So trying to get exercise and living where I do here in Southern California, especially, you know, I just felt really grateful when the pandemic began that I could go outside every day for mm-hmm. the most part. And we live near the mountains of San Gabriel, so I like to go hiking. I do like to travel, you know, as much as I can, but I don't travel that much. My partner, Adam, he's in graduate school, and he's also a youth soccer coach. And the schedule for that is he has to work weekends usually because that's when the games are. And then he also has practices during weekdays. So for much of the year. So a lot of our trips are just, you know, beautiful places, but the relatively short drive, like Joshua Tree mm-hmm. or Ojai, and then sometimes up to the Central Coast. But, you know, it's a good question. I mean, I'm not this avid cook or anything like that. I wish I could garden. I did live in a house once where I had a little garden, but we're in an apartment building here, so not a lot of gardening, but mm-hmm. I have plants and I like to tend to them. And I think I was a French major, so I speak French. I used to speak it better, but I'm curious about other cultures, so reading up on that. And those are some of my interests, I guess, besides figuring out what I'm going to write about and then writing and also teaching and talking to students. I work mostly with MFA students, graduate students. So they're fairly advanced writers and need a lot of input on their workshop submissions and their thesis, their manuscripts that they turn in when they're finishing their degree. And I'm never bored, I'll put it that way. There's always a lot to do.
I would imagine that you would, and we're going to come back to this after our break, but I imagine that reading other people's work, if they have followed the general rule, which is write about what you know, what you have lived through, I would imagine you get an interesting spectrum of people and experiences that many people don't get because of you get to see into somebody's writing. And maybe through their writing, you see a bit of their soul or their experiences. But at any rate.
Yeah. I mean, you do. It's funny you mentioned Gillian Flynn, because I wonder what she would say. Fortunately, she hasn't experienced a lot of the harrowing murders and violent events that are in her novel, but her novels. But I mean, I think a lot of my students probably do write about events that have happened to them. Some of them, though, are writing science fiction or horror. So those might be based in part on impressions or experiences or feelings they've had. But usually the events themselves and the stories are not, you know, fortunately real. But I've also worked with some nonfiction graduates who are, of course, writing about real events and real people. So I find it fascinating. But each time I'm always reminded how incredibly hard it is to be a good writer. And just the amount of time most people have to put into the craft to, you know, have any sort of mastery. And it's years, you know, it takes years. And our culture is so interested in like the overnight success and youthful, you know, the people who are already sort of wonder, or they're wunderkinds. And I just don't think most people, that's not our experience. Most of us have taken a long time to become good at something. And so this sort of like false dichotomy of someone who's 25 and publishing this blockbuster novel, it's just a very rare thing. And I think sometimes people entering MFA programs feel like they're going to be, you know, they're writing a book and then they're on their way. After a while, most of them figure out that it's going to take a while, you know. Some students are older, so they already have had more experience, but there's often still a pretty big learning curve. But by the end of the program, quite a few students have improved markedly, fortunately. I mean, that's what we hope for anyway, and it's what happens in most cases.
We're going to take a break right now, and we're going to come back and talk some more about the really fascinating things Christine is laying out there. This is John Smetanka, Ryan With Respect. We're talking to Christine Sneed, the author of a recently released book called Please Be Advised, A Novel in Memos. We'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Christine Sneed, the author of a recently released book, Please Be Advised, subtitle, A Novel in Memos. This is John Smetanka. So Christine, when we broke, you were talking about, because you're a teacher now of writing and a critic of your students' writing, and I don't mean in a negative sense, but as a person who's helping the students to refine their craft, this has got to be a constant revelation as to how things get done in your business. Now, let me give you an example. I have talked to, on our show, a number of authors, and you're right. So many people have had to struggle. I remember one woman who got a three-book contract after her first book. She ended up sending her manuscript out to something like 1,000 agents, crawling all over Manhattan and other places, and rejected over and over and over again, 100 times. And finally, she got an offer from the second publisher who she had sent it to and who had previously rejected it. And then after that, she did. She got a three-book contract, which is a big deal, I guess.
Yes.
So,
yeah, it is.
But now, one of the other observations that has come about through this show for me, I've learned something, and that is most people go through life and they go on a zigzag pattern. That is, they go this direction, and life takes them in a different direction, and then back and forth and up and down. And of about the 700 people that have been guests on our shows, of all different persuasions, authors, politicians, sculptors, scientists, virtually every one of them, with six exceptions, started at some point and then zigzagged all over the place before they finally got to do what it was that made them interesting, not so much that, but rather successful in whatever terms their craft would define it. And it's the six people who didn't, who actually started off wanting to be a pianist, concert pianist, and went straight, you know, as an arrow, till they were 25 and they were recognized and finally went on. But it was no variation. And I've always said to people, and say it again, that it's not the direct liners that are the most interesting people. The ones who are the most interesting people are the ones who go through zigzags. Mm-hmm. They go, it's a death in the family, a divorce, losing a job, parent has this or that problem, and, you know, there's wars, there's whatever it is. Takes people in different directions, and all of us sit back in the quiet of our homes and we say, you know, if only I'd gone on that direct path, I could be so much farther. And the answer is, you wouldn't be half as interesting. You wouldn't be. I don't know what you think about that.
I really think there's something to that. It's just, part of it is just, if you're going to be a writer or a creator in some way, I think you have to be a curious person. And I tell my students, you know, usually if I remember to do this at the end of a quarter or the end of a semester, depending on where I'm teaching, you know, go out and be kind. Number one, be kind. And then also, you know, never sacrifice your curiosity. Always hold on to it. Because I don't remember who said it, but curiosity is, you know, sort of at the foundation of our humanity.
Mm-hmm.
Curiosity about other people and other experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, people who've had a number of different careers or have followed interests until they realized, well, for whatever reason, I need to do something else now. You know, whether it's if they've started a family and they aren't making enough money to support the family, so they have to pivot, or they realize, you know, I really have always wanted to be a basket weaver, and I've been a pharmacist, but I actually really want to be a basket weaver, so I'm going to figure out how to do it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, some of the students I meet in the MFA program may have other jobs. Some of them are attorneys, like you. Some of them have worked in usually some sort of verbal job. They've worked in marketing, or they've done a lot of copy editing, or, you know, something that is somewhat literary, or at least literary adjacent. But they, you know, some of them have traveled pretty widely, or they've lived abroad. It's just, I mean, if you want to be a writer, I think you have to be really as I said, aside from being curious, you just have to be open to the world, and you have to really want to see it, and in a clear way. I think good writing is clear and specific, usually, or at least highly specific. Because, you know, the personal is the universal. I'm not quoting that properly either, but that's the gist of it. But yeah, I think interesting people have they just have different stories to tell, and they've had different experiences. They're not doing the same thing throughout their lives, usually. There are exceptions, obviously, but.
Well, it is. It is the exceptions. But they are exceptions. The ones that, as they say, start off at 2 months old writing, and they produce novel, scientific work, or whatever it is, piece after piece, until they die. You know, but it's unusual. I think it's quite unusual and not necessary. And when it comes to writing, I really think that the person who has had a wide range of experiences in life can produce some of the best writing. But at any rate, now I've got to talk about your book. You've got this book called Please Be Advised, A Novel in Memos. All right. How much do you want to reveal of this book without getting into spoilers? Let's talk about where did you get this idea about writing this book?
You know, I just finished, this was in 2017 when I wrote a lot of Please Be Advised. I just finished another novel that was also a comedic novel, and it was more straightforward and written in, you know, not in memo form, just in prose form. And I was so tired from that, and I didn't think I could immediately start writing anything too long, but I began writing the memos that then became part of Please Be Advised because they were short. And I thought I could just do a couple. But then I kept writing them because I started really liking the characters, and I liked the voice of, you know, certainly, you know, since you read it, there are different characters. And so not all the memos are written by the same person. And I was just having fun. And I used to teach business writing for Loyola University in Chicago and for DePaul University. So I have, you know, I have a lot of experience with that form, and know specifically, if you're trying to write a business memo, I can teach you how to do it. And yeah, and I just wanted to upend the whole business speak model too, where you have to be really tactful about the information that you're conveying, especially if it's bad news. Like if you're writing to everyone at a big company about a salary freeze or layoffs, you know, how do you say that so that it's not as terrible as it sounds? But to me, the whole idea of the fact that you can't be straightforward about it is just sort of laughable too, because people know. So that book was that I wrote that book kind of wanting to subvert all the rules, I guess, around office culture and office correspondence. And I just kept going. It was really a great fun experience. I really enjoyed writing it.
Well, if I can summarize the part of it without giving away everything, we've got a company called Quest Industries. And these folks talk to each other in all different kinds of ways. And everybody in the company is exchanging something. You wonder if they ever talk to each other outside of memos, but I'm sure they must. But we have memos from the CEO, from upper, and this is defined in the memos, upper level management sends a memo, middle level management sends a letter. A memo. Lower level management sends corporate officials, big people, little people, everybody's sending memos to one another and telling about what. Now, I've got to stop now because we do have to take a break. But when we come back, I want you to walk us through the different kinds of people, these fascinating characters that pop up in Please Be Advised. And how you got to craft these people. All right, this is John Smetanka. Right. We're on With Respect, and we're talking to Christine Sneed, the author of Please Be Advised, A Novel in Memos, which she's about to describe for us. We'll be right back. Now back on With Respect with Christine Sneed, the author of a new book called Please Be Advised, A Novel in Memos. Now, this is John Smetanka, and we're talking to Christine about this book, which is the format is everything is in computerized memos, or if they're not computerized, they're posted on a billboard somewhere in the company. Tell me about these people that you wrote about and how they interacted with each other.
You know, I am not sure where they all originated. I think they're not based on people I worked with. I did work in a company in the building where the book is set. It's set at One East Racker Drive, which is actually a real location, and the building there is I used to work on the 30th floor of that building, and I think there's 38 or 39, I can't remember, it was so long ago, it was 2 years after college. And I think I just wanted to have people who were likable, but also flawed. And the CEO is this British man, Brian Stokely Esquire, who is sort of a fabrication in his own, he's really not qualified at all to be a CEO of a company. He has a BFA in fiber arts, but no one knows that when, you know, he's there until the very end, when a lot of things start sort of devolving and unraveling. And I feel a fondness for some of the people I worked with back in the 90s when I was at this company called Energy Absorption Systems, which is a highway safety products company. And I worked for the VP of International. I was his secretary when we still use that word. I think now you're an administrative assistant or an executive assistant. So I was his, you know, his assistant and did a lot of his correspondence, sort of just grudge work. And but it was fine. I mean, I knew I was probably going to graduate school before long, and that is what I ended up doing. And the people, you know, some of them are just like people I knew when I worked at Energy Absorption Systems. They're lonely, or they're divorced, or they're they're out in the dating world and they're trying to also be successful in their jobs. And I really wanted to sort of play up the comedy and the pathos of the fact that many of us have to spend, you know, the majority of the hours every day of the week working in an office with people who maybe we get along with, but if we didn't have to be there, we wouldn't be.
Mm-hmm.
And that really is kind of an undercurrent, the idea that if you could, wouldn't you go somewhere else? Wouldn't you do something else with your life? And, you know, we all have to pay our bills. So most people just are clinging to those jobs, even if they really don't like them and they don't necessarily get along with the other people in their office. They just try to make it through each day as best mm-hmm. they can.
Well, you know, one of the things two words you used a little bit a few minutes ago, and you said comedic and yet pathos. There's a certain pathos about these characters, just like you described. That is, they've got to make a living to pay their bills, and maybe they enjoy what they're doing, or they're producing something that they like to produce widgets. I don't know, but it's the book I found very funny. I found it. I liked some of these characters faster and more than I thought I was going to, because you chiseled out good characters here. So it's interesting to see how they interact in your writing and in your mind, your observation. So with again, without giving anything about the denouement of this group of people, what happens? What's the thing that brings them together? Let me say that one of the things I found fascinating is you are describing a group or a series of groups of people within a company and within a world. And it reminded me of Kurt Vonnegut's book, I can't remember which one it came from, Cat's Cradle or whatever, in which he talks about the Grand Falloons and the Carasses and the Wampeters. These are different kinds of organizations, different kinds of people, but it's how people interact with each other. And that's what these folks are doing. They're held together by this company and their relationships to their fellow workers, their fellow memo writers. And sometimes it works and sometimes it kind of falls apart. It's funny but it's also sad in a way.
No, it's interesting. I'm so glad, yeah, that you mentioned the range of responses that you had, because it's been the word tender keeps resurfacing when people have who read it, friends or other people who have written reviews on Goodreads or Amazon or wherever it is, they've said, you know, this is surprisingly tender. And I hadn't really been thinking about that at all when I was working on the book. But I realized later, because I've done a number of readings since it came out in October, and I thought, you know, I get it. Like, I thought that I realized that people are responding to the matchmaker plot thread, where the office manager, Ken Crickshaw Jr., is sort of inducted into this office matchmaker role, as well as the other roles that he fills in the company. And Bill and Hannah Louise, the first two people he matches, their story, I just realized people were responding to the lunacy of some of the confessional type remarks that they make in their updates when they send these emails/memos to the rest of the company, which is, I think, about 180 people. They're just a lot of very inappropriate disclosures about private matters and, you know, but at the same time, I think I really was attempting to have a similar tone throughout the book, so that even when people are disclosing somewhat shocking or, you know, aggressively inappropriate information about themselves, there's this sort of upbeat, you know, almost sprightly tone to the voice of each of the memos, except for some of the ones that are more scolding, like the efficiency specialist that's brought in, Robert Hrbenka, when he comes in and yells at everyone for hoarding paper and not sorting through all their junk and stuff. So it was just a lot of fun to,
well,
to write. Been,
as I yeah. read as I read this, I was going through my memory bank of various organizations that I've been involved in, from very small ones through huge organizations. And I loved to do my own assessment of the people that I work with that might fit into one of these categories or one of these characters. And it was fun. It was a game that I got involved in. And it made me enjoy the book. And go through, as I went through it, I kept saying, I know that person. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I'm so glad.
Oh, I once did a show with a fellow who wrote a book about traveling on boxcars. And there was murders and there was burglaries and rapes and lying and cheating and all this. And all I could think of as I went through this book that was just unrelenting misery and bad people was that I'd prosecuted every single kind of person that was listed in this book as a character. There was no heroes. And so I mentioned this to the author, and he said, oh, really? Oh, great. I'm going to tell my friends. And he sent me an email back weeks later, and he said, I just want to tell you how pleased I was with his show, because I told my friends, the host said he'd prosecuted every single one of my characters. I must have gotten them real.
Yeah, it's so funny. He was delighted by that.
Oh, what he was. Fuck? He was so pleased. I thought, wow, easily pleased, man.
I'm glad that he. It sounds so familiar. What's the title? I want to seek it out. If that's okay to ask.
You can ask, but I don't remember, and I will not. I will not reveal the source. but it was a real book. I have it in my library.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah, well, yeah. We'll leave it as, it may be as familiar because there's other people out who write this kind of stuff that could be prosecuted by a prosecutor. And so, the names have been changed to protect the innocent. But at any rate, let's go back. In sketching out these people as they interact to each other, What do you think it says about the way we organize ourselves as a society? If you have any thoughts along those lines, I do, but I want to see if you have some.
It's such a good question. Wow, what were you going to say? I think I interrupted you. Sorry.
No, let's go ahead.
I think, well, certainly, one thing I kept thinking about was the CEO's ego, and the fact that he was the highest paid member of the office and certainly the guy in charge. So he was well remunerated, and you find out near the end of the book, how much he was earning. And then there was some embezzlement going on, and there's just the IRS audit, but you find that out. But I think I definitely was thinking in a hierarchical way, because there are the support staff members of Quest Industries. I was one at a similar, sort of corporate entity, as I mentioned, the 2 years after college before I went to grad school. And, we did a lot of work that was, it was important in the sense that we needed to obviously be able to communicate with other companies. And so we were making phone calls and writing a lot, or typing up a lot of correspondence for our supervisors, our bosses. But we weren't making all the decisions about how to manage sales or how to increase sales or any of the things that were really noticeably increasing the bottom line for the company. So we were not looked at as very important. We were certainly looked at as quite replaceable. And I think that's something that was maybe in the back of my mind as I was working on Please Be Advised, the fact that there's always going to be a division between people who are considered, or at least I should say, there's sort of, whether it's spoken or not, there is, depending on how much money you make, that's your importance and your worth is always tied to that, I think, in corporate culture. So if you're getting paid $30,000 a year to type letters, and someone else is getting paid $300,000 a year as the VP of sales, you can guess who is going to be more important to the CEO or the CFO and to the shareholders, and the personalities, often are tailored to match the salaries, I think. So that, I love that question.
And we take that and we say, what does it say about our society in terms of valuing people in the society? Now we're talking about not Quest Industries, not a particular company or a particular group, but society generally. How much do we value, and what about people do we value? Is it the money they make? Is it how good looking they are? Is it how articulate they are? How popular they are? Some particular accomplishment that made them a celebrity. So celebrities are getting a lot of TV and ink and whatnot. So is there any play out into the outside world, out of the company, that you captured in this book, you observed in this book, and I think one of them is money. Who makes the most money as the most valued? But somebody else has got to make some, have to be valued, even if they don't make as much money. But what about it? Any thoughts on this?
No, I love that question. Yeah, I mean, I think people, unfortunately, unless you know someone well or relatively well, you don't necessarily know that, wow, they make a really good loaf of bread or they keep a beautiful patch of roses outside their front door, or they are just someone who has memorized 15 Shakespearean or sonnets of Shakespeare and they can recite them, you know, at will. We don't often know those things, and I don't know if as a society we value things like that, at least not in any kind of widespread way. People just, I guess the sort of yardstick is always about money and looks and youth. You know, that's a lot of it, but I think money above all. And then it's certainly swagger, people who are, you know, good at promoting themselves, especially with the rise of influencers on social media who, you know, have, some of them are genuinely talented. I don't spend a lot of time. I'm not even on TikTok or Instagram, but you know, there's people on there who do have ability and are, you know, interesting or talented. But I just think that it's sometimes just like, you know, people cite Kim Kardashian as being famous for being famous. Like, what are her real talents aside from marketing herself? You know, I don't know, because I've never watched Keeping Up with the Kardashians, but people become famous just because they're good looking and they happen to be always on social media. And I just don't see that being a good foundation for society.
Well, Christine, we're going to take another break. When we come back, I want to talk about your new book, which you don't even know you're going to write, but I'm going to tell you what it is after we get back. This is John Smetanka on With Respect, and we're talking to Christine Sneed, the author of Please Be Advised, A Novel in Memos. We'll be right back. Now on With Respect with our guest this week, Christine Sneed, the author of Please Be Advised, A Novel in Memos. This is John Smetanka. All right, Christine, here it is. This is the book you're going to have to write, whether you like it or not. Before you came on this this program with me, you didn't know it, but here it is. You started this book in 2017. You finished it. You know, we know how hard it is to get a book published. But something happened in 2020 that makes for a whole new book. And it's called COVID. And the change that this has, that period of time, which exists, it has caused for some years, a change in our society, our work society, our social society, our family society. What are we left with? Is this corporation Quest Industries, if you were writing the book today, would you write it this way, or would you start talking about trying to get people back into the office? They're working remote all the time, and that's a priceless thing. What do you think?
You know, it's so funny you ask that, because I have written a memo for this literary magazine in San Francisco, which publishes a print edition 3 or 4 times a year, but they also have an online edition. And I wrote a back to work memo in the voice of the sort of scolding, I think, mid-level management voice that I use sometimes. And Please Be Advised, so this was a response to the pandemic and was requiring people to show up in the office wearing appropriate attire, because I think a lot, I mean, I remember back in March of 2020 and the immediate months after, the fact people were just wearing sweatpants, and sweatpants vendors or whoever they were, their designer sweatpants, they were selling out because people were buying these to wear at home. And I think there's a whole opportunity, there's a big opportunity if you want to write. For example, there's a novel, which some of your listeners, and you might have read it yourself. I haven't actually read much of it. I looked at the intro or the sample on Kindle. I think it's called Several People Are Typing by this writer named Calvin Kasulka. And it's on one of those internal message systems, Slack. I don't know if you use that or are familiar with it. But it's just a messaging system where if you're subscribed or in that group for, people at your office, you have immediate access to each other. It's like a text chain, but it's, it's through your computer usually. And you can do it as an app on your phone too. But that, I think Calvin Kasulka, the author of that book, he was sort of, I don't know if he wrote it during the pandemic. I can't remember exactly when it came out, but there is technology now that you could mimic in a book if you were going to write an office comedy that also takes into account the last 3 years. It's hard to believe now that it has been 3 years since this began.
It is amazing, isn't it? I have found in my law firm, in my life, in the life of the people around me, that there are changes psychologically and societal changes that are remarkable. It's like there is BC, before COVID, and after COVID, AC. And the question I have, and tease it out with you and see what you think, has COVID, not the disease itself, but our ways of trying to cope with it, have they made permanent changes in our country, in our society? Are we ever going to go back to Quest Industries, that pyramidal organization that you described so well? Or is the model completely shattered and we're just putting a new one back together piece by piece? What do you think?
Well, I mean, there certainly are different industries where it's had a pretty deleterious effect, like the movie industry, the fact that a lot of theater chains were really struggling and some of them folded entirely. I used to go to a movie in the theater every week or two. And, I miss that. I have gone back a few times, but that's definitely been a major change. And I think more people are also watching limited series or TV series instead of film too. And as someone who's been learning how to write films and TV shows and pilots, I've noticed that feature films are just not the property that they used to be, the hot property that they used to be. So, because people aren't going to the multiplexes as much.
Mm-hmm.
There are certainly big pictures like the Marvel comic or the DC comic movies that are still bringing in big crowds because they just want to see the spectacle. But I don't go to those. I don't go to those movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I might watch them occasionally at home, but they're not my... they're not the type of films that I'm excited about. So I know I'm kind of in the minority, at least in the American marketplace. And a lot more people, I think, order just everyday goods online and have them delivered.
Mm-hmm.
There's still brick and mortar stores and bookstores, fortunately, are still doing pretty well, independent bookstores. But, it's very tempting to just order something instead of try to go out and find a nice pair of shoes. Well, if you look on Amazon or whatever purveyor you use, there's hundreds of pairs, thousands of them really. So it's just so much easier to get onto your computer to order things. And then if you don't like them, you return them, mail them back. So I think that's something that a lot of vendors retailers have had to reckon with. But I do think people still need to be together. So restaurants seem to be recovering and there's certainly a normal amount of traffic on the road out here in LA and in Chicago when I've gone home for holidays and other visits, there's been the usual amount of traffic. So, I mean, we're still seeing each other face to face and craving community. So I don't think we're never going to be any, I mean, I feel like we still have, we have recovered in a way, but people, I just stay home and watch stuff. I wait for it to be on a streaming platform instead of going to the movies.
Well, you're,
I know there've got to be more examples, but those are the ones that come readily.
No, those are good examples. In fact, it's in my family, we have had for generations an interest in movies, books, and magazines and whatnot. Television, yes, but books and movies as an important part of our social life. Now it's changed. I haven't been back to a theater movie for, I take it back about 3-4 weeks ago, we went in to see one movie. But before that, it was a year. And one of the problems that I see is the quality of the current genre of movies does not seem to, it's not interesting to me, and I don't think it's as interesting to a large segment of our population. It's just not, they're not as concise or good as they were perhaps even 20 years ago. But that's a sidelight. But I want to take something of what you said and highlight it, and that is, even though we were forced into isolation and we had already started down the line of the internet shopping and internet communications, I think that the COVID time reinforced those, made them necessary, not just luxuries. However, I think we're beginning to understand that face-to-face communication is inescapable if you want to accomplish and main some goal, and if you want to keep society from degenerating into something like what was that great Soylent Green movie about a dystopic society? And so I put that to you. I'm interested in your reaction to that. I think what you have highlighted in Quest Industries is a group of people interacting with one another. There is interaction outside of the memos that you write about. However, there is, you capture so much of the corporate culture when you talk, when you have, you know, put the memos one after the other. But I think that contact, person-to-person contact, where it's a real face, that a real hand you can shake, whatnot, is still extremely important and will be important as long as there are people.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I know that as soon as I can get vaccinated and fly home from Los Angeles to Chicago, I did it. I mean, because I was a professor, I was able to get a vaccine or a shot pretty early. It was in March of 2021. So as soon as I had both doses, I was booking a flight back to Chicago so I could see my parents and my close friends. Mm-hmm. And that was so just joyful. I mean, we all missed being together. I think a lot of us, most of us were still worried about infecting each other, even if we didn't have symptoms. But now I have been, also another thing that I like to do is spinning the class at the gym on bicycles, stationary bikes. And so I've been going back to the spin club, the studio. It's just basically a block from where I live. And I've started doing that in the last week. And I hadn't done it for 3 years almost. So, and people just are sort of going about their business, and I know it's still somewhat risky, but, you know, it seems like people just are kind of like, well, I'm hoping I don't get sick, and I hope I don't get anyone else sick, but I just kind of want to live my life again the way I was living it.
That's right. And what we like, whether we admit it or not, and whether we have exceptions, there's some people I cannot stand, let's say, but what we accept the fact that there is people out there we don't like. We want to be with people. We want to touch, talk, listen to, talk to people, not just computers and not just emails. FaceTime and chats and that sort of thing doesn't really completely solve that human problem, the human need for talking to one another real time. That's just my personal take on it. That's why I find your book interesting, but I demand that you take that wit and take that analysis of people and create some characters and write this book that I want you to write about this dystopic world that we have right now. All right. Christine, I enjoyed talking to you. I enjoyed reading your book. I am looking forward to your other writings. Hope you take my suggestions. But the name of your book is Please Be Advised, A Novel in Memos, available at your local bookstore. This is John Smetanka. And again, thanks very much for joining us, Christine. And I hope I wish you the best in the future.
Thank you, John. This was really a delight. I really appreciate it, too.
Sure thing. So this is John Smetanka. We're on every Sunday and Thursday. And remember, until next time, if you show respect to other people, they will show respect to you.